This season of the Curiosity Club podcast is sponsored by Simprove. Simprove is committed to furthering the understanding of the function and role of the gut microbiome by using a scientific approach to developing the most effective bacteria-based product. Put simply, Simprove helps to support your gut microbiome and balance your gut bacteria. What I love about it is its water-based formulation that contains four unique strains of live activated bacteria. Because of this unique formulation, Simprove will not trigger digestion, meaning the bacteria will arrive to your gut unharmed and in full strength, survive the harsh acidic environment that is your stomach, and thrive in your gut to colonise successfully. Simprove's 12-week programme will give you the best chance of nourishing your gut bacteria and supporting your gut microbiome. The more I learn about gut health, the more important I realise it is. And I'm currently in my 12-week programme and I love knowing that I am supporting and topping up the good bacteria that lives within me. If you want to join me on your own programme, Simprove have been kind enough to give all you lovely curious folk a special 15% discount for a limited time using the code CuriosityClub15. Welcome to the Curiosity Club podcast, a safe place for the real life lessons that we didn't get taught in school. Each season, I have conversations with inspiring experts who share their wisdom around our seven peaks of curiosity. Together, we learn how to break the patterns, habits, and mindsets that limit our potential, hinder our happiness, and impact our well-being. I'm your host, life and business coach, Katri Barrett, and these are the life lessons for modern humans. Welcome to episode 2, season 2. This week, I'm speaking to psychotherapist and author Julia Samuel. As one of the UK's leading psychotherapists, Julia helped launch and establish the charity Child Bereavement UK and was awarded an NBE in recognition of her services to bereaved children, as well as an honorary doctorate from Middlesex University. Julia has also published not one, but two Sunday Times bestseller books. Her first, Grief Works, was published in 17 countries, and her second came out earlier this year, titled This Too Shall Pass, Stories of Change, Crisis, and Hopeful Beginnings, which I have recently finished devouring. And you know when you just read one of those books that just articulates so much of what you have felt and believed in a way that you haven't quite been able to yet? As someone who is passionate about embracing one of the only certainties in life, and that is change, This Too Shall Pass was one of those books for me. Julia also has a private practice where she sees families and individuals for many different reasons. As an expert in change and grief, I was really keen to ask for her thoughts on how different people may have experienced the last few months during the pandemic and all that has been going on with the Black Lives Matter movement. As within both of these spheres, there has been a lot of uncertainty, change, loss, and not to mention grief. Julia reflects and gives a lot of incredible insights on how we can channel all of this into positive, healthy, and most importantly, sustainable change. We go further into the relationship between change and grieving, and Julia unpacks some of the biggest misconceptions that surround both, as well as her eight-pillar process that anyone can use to help them feel steady when it feels like the world is spinning around them. I think most people will get so much from listening to Julia, especially if you have ever been left feeling the fury, frozen by numbness, stuck in anxiety, or the confusion that comes with loss. Whether that's after the death of a loved one or in what Julia describes as living loss, which we can all experience during change, such as a breakup, as we age, losing a job, getting divorced, becoming parents, or most recently, during a pandemic. I would love to hear your reflections on this episode, so please do let me know by leaving a rating and review if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, and I would love it if you were to take a screenshot and tag at @thecuriosityclub_ over on your Instagram story so that I can connect with you there. Enjoy. Just a quick note, most of the interviews were recorded during lockdown over Zoom, which isn't the best for audio. So please do excuse the sound quality. We were doing the best with what we had.
So welcome to the Curiosity Club, Julia. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really, really excited to talk to you. But can we start with you just telling us and the listeners a little bit more about who you are, your incredible work and your journey to kind of where you are today?
It's lovely to meet you and to be on your podcast, and hello to your listeners. I'm a psychotherapist. I have been a psychotherapist for 30 years. A big chunk of my professional life was working in the NHS. I worked in a big London hospital in the maternity and paediatrics units, supporting families when babies and children died. And that was incredibly sort of heart-expanding, difficult, extraordinary work that I feel enormously grateful for. And, you know, they taught me so much, those families, and that's really got me into specialising in grief, which was what my first book was about, Grief Works. But also from then in sort of 25 years ago, I was found a patron and helped establish and launch a charity to support families when a child dies or when a child is bereaved, called Child Bereavement UK. And I worked with them for 25 years, kind of a lot, but I've stepped down. I'm not a trustee. I don't do fundraising, but I'm just a very loving patron who's always, you know, it will always care about the charity. And now I work in private practice. I've written a second book, This Too Shall Pass, Stories of Change, Crisis and Hopeful Beginnings. And I'm curious to see what the next 10 years will bring.
And I've got your book here. I'm not going to pick it up because it's going to knock the computer, but I've just finished reading This Too Shall Pass, which came out at the beginning of this year, beginning of 2020.
Came out just a week before lockdown. The 5th of March.
Oh, wow. So it was really recent. That's how, because I found it and I've listened to, I haven't read Grief Works, but it was last year. My sister actually recommended the podcast that kept the series of episodes, and they were just such powerful listens and conversations and so important. And I'm so interested and keen to talk to you about both grief and change with you today, and the relationship between the two. And I feel, and myself included in this, I think I certainly did until quite recently, and until diving into a lot of your work, but I think most people tend to associate grief predominantly with death. And I was wondering if you could you talk us through perhaps the different manifestations of grief that you see coming up for people?
So I call what we're sort of in now, and probably the whole world has experienced, as a living loss. And I talk about it in This Too Shall Pass. And so that's any ending that does, you experience it exactly the same as grief, where you feel fury and confusion and sadness and stuckness and numbness and, you know, don't understand who you are or what you're going to do. And that can happen from a job ending, from divorce, from moving country, and certainly during a pandemic where you're all locked down and your whole life is turned upside down and you no longer know what you're doing or what your future holds. And so, and some people call it anticipatory grief, but actually anticipatory grief, a lot of this, you're in it. So you're not anticipating it. So that's why I think a living loss is a more accurate description. And my message for both grief after death and living loss is twofold. One is that it's the love and connection to others at the time of the loss and after the loss that will predict your outcome. And that includes your relationship with yourself. So be self-compassionate. Mm-hmm. And the other one is that pain is the agent of change. That it's discomfort at one end or real kind of searing pain at the other end that forces us to recognize that our reality is different to what we expected or wanted. And it forces us to adjust to that new reality that we never wanted. And if we don't adjust, the research is kind of indisputable. Those that don't adapt and change have less joy and less success in life, and then have more difficulty when change comes around again, which it does. I mean, the research shows it's sort of every 7 to 10 years. Right now, it's like almost every other day. But
absolutely. I love that. I love how you describe that as living loss. And I think for me, in particular, over the last few months, I think it is important to note, I think we're recording this, it's the 9th of June 2020. So we're a few months into coronavirus pandemic within the UK, which is where we're recording it, and I think it's it's really highlighted to me the different experiences of grief, and I've been so curious about that as an experience, whereas lots of people I haven't seen people articulating it in that way or being able to acknowledge that, see that within themselves. It's just why I was so keen to talk to you in this, you know, at the moment. And I love how you describe that as living loss and as the experience. And it's something that you're very much within at the time, and how best to kind of adapt and navigate to change. I think there's everything that's been going on with the pandemic over the last few months, and there's been a lot going on in the world, and in the last 2 weeks ago with the killing of George Floyd by the police in America. And I'd be really intrigued to hear your reflections on you know, perhaps how you said that living loss and that grief and that sitting in that discomfort, but I'd be really keen to hear your reflections on what else has been going on.
I mean, I think in relation to George Floyd, I guess you need to look at it very personally, that it's a devastating loss for his family that needs to be acknowledged. And in some ways, I feel there's a discomfort in using him, you know, when death and grief is so incredibly personal and intimate. And yet it seems that he is, and I think his family are okay with it, an agent of change, that he is forcing us. You know, we remember and we forget, we remember and we forget, we kind of, and don't change. And I think what I see and what I hope in the last few weeks is that it's kind of reached a tipping point where we can no longer, you know, people like you and me, just kind of believe that we're not racist and not speak. And I think all of us are beginning to acknowledge the microaggressions, these unconscious systemic historical bias that's racist. And the more that we face the discomfort internally of that, you know, the shame that I feel and how I'd rather turn away from it, then I think more change is likely to occur. With me, with clients, obviously, you know, I work with a very diverse group of clients. And the thing I always say is, you know, when we meet, our histories meet. And there are aspects of your life that I may never know or not fully understand. So if I get something wrong or I misunderstand you or I'm making an assumption or I've been insensitive, just tell me. Internally, as a therapist, I kind of hope I've done my work and done my reading. But of course, there's always transgressions I can make that I would never intend to do or want to do.
And it seems I think what's so important as well. I agree with you, that openness to I might make mistakes here, and it was really interesting what you just said about that remember forget cycle, that cyclical that we've been stuck in for too long when it in terms of racism, and how we can break that cycle to make a new one of anti-racism. And I think that's so important. So thank you for sharing your views on that. I'm really interested to hear and to explore a little bit with you what you see as some of the biggest misconceptions that surround grief in itself. So we're talking sort of grief, and then we're talking more about change and the relationship between the two. But let's start with those biggest misconceptions that you tend to see.
I think the biggest misconception is about time, that time is a great healer and that you get over it. You know, people often say to someone whose husband has died, you know, I think it's time to move on now. You know, I think you should start dating. Or someone whose child has died, you know, I know it's really sad, but, you know, have another child, that kind of thing, that you can move on and step forward. And time does change your relationship with grief in the sense that the total preoccupation, the way that it kind of is all encompassing and all that you're aware of, lessens over time if you get support, and the intensity of the pain on the whole changes over time. But you can go back 20 years later and feel the searing new kind of intensity of the pain now, you know, at moments, anniversaries or particular smells or, you know, something that ignites it. And how I see grief is that it's something that you accommodate. So the image, I don't know if your listeners are listening, so if you put your sort of hands in a circle, when someone dies, that's all you're aware of. It's like becomes all of you, and that's all you're thinking about. It's all you're preoccupied with and ruminating and feeling the pain. And over time, that circle stays the same, but you build your life around it so that you have more experiences. You may marry again. You may have another child. You may move country. You experience joy. You experience pleasure in life. But that loss is always there. And the wound is always there, and it can be raw, like I said before, or it's either front of mind or the back of your mind. That's what I often talk about with clients. And I think one of the difficulties in grief is that there's this dilemma, is that pain connects you to the person that's died, that it kind of, you feel like you're doing the right thing by them, that they're very present in your life and you're kind of showing them, demonstrating how much you love them by how much pain you're in. But on the other hand, it's impossible to kind of reinvest in life and engage with life if you're totally preoccupied with the pain of the person that's gone. So what I talk about is that the person comes forward in front of mind when you're really focusing on it, like when they come and see me. And that other times they can choose, and you can't always choose, to put them at the back of the mind, knowing that you can recall them whenever you need. And so that's the other sort of big thing, is that the relationship continues. So the person has died and you have to face the loss of their physical presence, but the love never dies. And so it's touchstones to memory, how you connect and remember them. And it may be wearing a bracelet, it may be cooking your mum's cottage pie, it may be going for walks with a friend, picking wildflowers while you're talking about them. But it's through remembering, and it's not forgetting. So my parents' generation, who kind of fought in the Second World War, they would talk about get over and get on, to forget and move on. Although, of course, the memorials always said, lest we forget, that they didn't want you to forget. But the sort of culture was to forget. I think we understand that very differently now.
Absolutely. I read somewhere recently, I'm not sure, it might have been something that you said, but and I found this really interesting, that it was going back a little bit further than that, but the Victorians did grief very, very well. They did sex conversations terribly. However, nowadays we talk about sex very well, but we do grief very, very badly. And that really like struck a chord. It was like a light bulb moment for me with that. Have I read that?
That was me. I actually don't think we talk about sex a lot. I don't think we talk about sex very well, but we can find ways of talking about it, whereas we're very uncomfortable talking about death. Yeah. And the reverse was true of the Victorians.
When I read that, I've spoken to loads of people about it since reading that. It really kind of just didn't mm-hmm. like, of course, because it is something that, and that's why I was really, really keen to do this episode and talk to you in particular about this, because I just think it's something that's avoided, it's something we all experience at some point and to different degrees, whether it's the living loss or whether it's the loss of a loved one or however it looks like. It's so important to have these conversations, these understandings of, you know, that there is no shoulds or shouldn'ts, that like you were saying, that it's not something the time will, you'll just move on and that will be done with, and that it's about finding those connections. How else would you kind of describe kind of healthy grief, which I heard you describe it as? What does that look like, and what can people do if they are struggling at the moment?
Just to go back one second to put in something from what you're saying, I think something about the pandemic, about not talking about grief. I mean, I've been banging on or death, you know, for 30 years, saying that what we don't talk about does us harm and it causes regrets. And that's the biggest derailer of grieving, is regrets, things you didn't say, things you didn't know, things you didn't ask. And I think the pandemic has brought our mortality uncomfortably much more up close and personal. And so I hope it means that people have had those conversations, and so that they will be more informed and more kind of have less fault lines when someone they love dies. And your question was, what are the other things to think about around grief?
What does healthy grief look like, and what can people do if they are struggling?
I think that most therapists and specialists in grief would say there's no one way to grieve. That it is both kind of very unique and also very universal. I think what's universal is the way that you kind of allow yourself to feel the pain or not. I mean, what's universal is that it's painful. I think where you can have a complex grief or a prolonged grief is influenced by lots of things. So it would be if you've had multiple losses before, you know, your history, your psychological profile, if you're someone who's had a lot of difficulties psychologically before, the relationship with the person that died. So was that a straightforward relationship? Was it a complex relationship? Difficult one, you know, a father that you've never seen, you'd think you wouldn't care, but then you do because the father you dreamed of and hoped for is now finally gone. And the circumstances of the death. So, of course, it's very different. An old person dying peacefully at home, aged 85, who you sat with and you kind of feel you said goodbye and they've had a good life and a long life, to a sudden traumatic death, you know, on an intensive care unit where you're watching them over the phone being relayed by someone in PPE watching the person you love die. So that is the biggest influence on how you grieve, which is different about what's healthy and what's not healthy, if you see what I mean. Mm. It's always influenced by who you are and what's happened to you, and what complex, prolonged grief looks like is, so the movement of loss is between the past and the present and the future, so that it's you allow yourself to feel the pain and you look back at the past, and that can free you to be in the present, have a break from the pain, have plans for the future. And it's the oscillation between the two is how you adjust between those poles of the past and your future. And if you have complex grief, you can get stuck in the middle between the poles and the past and the future, where you're completely locked, where you're not in your present, you don't look to the future, and it's too difficult to look at the past almost. If it's traumatic grief, it's very, you know, it's overwhelms you. And then you don't really function. You find it hard to communicate, you can't make plans. And when you're in pain like that, it overwhelms every other kind of aspect of who you are and your day, and therefore your life. You know, how you spend your days is how you spend your life. So that's at the most extreme. And there's sort of everything in between. And I think from someone who is basically healthy and, you know, it's an older person that's died, the thing that I think most interrupts healthy grieving is blocking the pain. So it's the things that you do to avoid the pain that over time do you harm. And I think nowadays the two biggest blockers are busyness, like being super busy is an anesthetic to feeling, and any kind of alcohol or drugs or kind of addictive sex, or where you're in that cycle where you're never kind of sober to process how you feel.
That's so interesting what you just said there about busyness now being such a common in our modern lives. It's, I always talk about it in my coaching work, it's like the badge of honor, like, oh, I've been so busy, I have, or how, when people, that's a response of how are you, I'm so busy. And it really is. And I think, and it's it, from what you were saying, I think that the key, that something already that's my sort of biggest takeaway of this is, again, it's that allowing space, like that pause, which again is something that I'm hopeful that this over during lockdown that perhaps people have had more capacity to be able to do, that ability of space to just pause and reassess and maybe allow a bit of emotional processing to kind of let themselves to feel things that maybe they have been perhaps unconsciously avoiding through via busyness or via coping strategies that perhaps have been taken away during this experience over the last few months. In particular, you've got your grief works, your first book, and this Two Shall Pass, which is focusing mostly about change. But I'm really keen. To me, it feels like there's an obvious relationship, but I don't know whether that is right. But what would you say in your words? What's the relationship between grief and change?
I think it's really what I said before, is that we often don't give living losses of change the credit and acknowledgement that they need. We kind of think, even particularly when good things happen, big good changes like we get married or we have a baby, we sort of think, well, our insides should match our outsides. But the event happens very quickly, you know, getting married or having a baby takes longer, obviously. But the process of adjustment takes much longer than the event. And people don't recognize that. Their previous identities, their previous selves, their previous ways of being, their previous decisions, all of that is in flux and turmoil. And it takes a long time in that same idea of the poles of the past and your present and future to kind of find your new settling point, your new internal landscape. And, you know, it's uncomfortable at one end and really terrible at the other end. So if you've had a baby and you're finding it awful, I think a lot of that is postnatal depression because you've lost your entire life. You know, who you were, how you behaved, and your sense of self. You're not for you anymore, you're for the baby. And, you know, my sort of big message is to recognize that, because people just think that they're doing it wrong and everybody else is doing it right. So to give themselves the self-compassion and permission that this is a kind of roller coaster process and support themselves through it. Don't kind of try and... don't beat themselves up is the big thing.
Absolutely. And what I really liked about in this Two Shall Pass was how you broke it up, as a few that you've mentioned there, into the sort of different areas of our life and the main different chapters. And you talk about that we all have a unique relationship to change, and you've spoken in a little bit about that in our conversation today. And that within those different areas, I think it's family, love, work, health, and identity. Would you be able to just, you have touched upon that a little bit, but just to help people perhaps, that those that are listening, to kind of recognise maybe their experiences within each of these areas, what perhaps are, that you see as common challenges, and or perhaps how and what comes up for people in those different areas?
I think the process of it, the internal process of it, the discomfort, feels annoying. It's like in family, love, work, health, and identity, the thing people were kind of pissed off about was, I want to get over it. I don't want to be upset because I hate my boss that sacked me. I don't want to be upset that my daughter is getting married and I feel kind of suddenly threatened by my age. I just want to be okay and want to kind of ignore it and get on. And, you know, we're not machines. And I think, you know, in the age of technology, we'd like the fast track app that is going to smart work us into being... into shape, to be the sort of curated Instagram version of herself who one day is single and is the next day married and everything is tickety-boo, look at me in my new place. And we're much messier, we're more chaotic, we're more disgruntled, we're more confused, we can be disappointed when we don't want to be. So it's all the kind of underbelly of life that we'd like to kind of tidy away and Marie Kondo our feelings into kind of tidy little drawers that you can kind of choose to pick out. Oh, I'm going to allow myself to have my pink pants and my disappointment today. And we just don't work like that.
I love that as a way of describing it. We want to Marie Kondo our emotions. And I think that's so true. And that, the fact that you acknowledge that desire of, I just want to get over it. I don't want to, today, I don't want to feel it. And I suppose, and it's reiterating that acceptance of what it is, of your experience in, and you mentioned something before about that it's how you live your day each day is how you live your life. So it's, I suppose, yeah, taking it one day at a time. Yeah. Do it. I think that's such, it's.
And I think a lot of the brands of wellness and things that are meant to be helpful are actually over perfecting and conditioning. So, you know, live your best life, be your best self. I can't think of all these awful expressions. I mean, and they're right. I want everyone to live their best life, but that isn't the Marie Kondo inside tidy pants life. It's messy and smells and, you know.
Absolutely. I think that is it. And I always try to avoid certain terminology like that. But I suppose, yeah, it all needs to come with a little kind of a little explanation, but that it's not that the best human life is a messy emotional roller coaster. And I think one of the certainties of life, a conversation I had with a client recently, is one of the certainties of life is change. That is probably one of the only things you can be certain of is things are uncertain. And during this time of the pandemic, that, you know, thrown around so much, that coping with uncertainty and all of those things. And I think that is life. And that's something I think that's hard. That's a hard pill to swallow, I think, knowing, especially, and you've talked about when things are good and you think you're feeling very good. That's, I think, when it can be harder. How did you see that in clients as well, when things are going well, that kind of fear of maybe things changing?
Yeah, well, I mean, the two things we're certain of are the two things we kind of want to avoid, is that change happens, and it happens biologically and through events, whether we like it or not, and death. So those are the two certainties. And, you know, I said that in the introduction of my book, but also in the title, This Too Shall Pass, people kind of use that for now, like difficult things pass. But of course, good things pass too. That's the hitch, you know, and we can't stay in that happy, everything perfect place, because that isn't how life operates, unfortunately. I think, you know, there's a lot that we can do that can influence and build our resilience, how we surf the kind of snakes and ladders of life. And I think that makes a big, big difference. But yeah, you can't fight it. That's the big thing. You have to surrender, really.
Surrendering, I think, is that's a lifelong practice, as I see it, learning how to do that. And
the serenity prayer, you know, I think is a fantastic badge to kind of wear in your mind all the time. You know, accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and have the wisdom to know the difference. I mean, that's a very good starting place, isn't it, when you're looking at something, you know, to kind of really recognize what you can influence and change and what you can't.
Absolutely. And regularly checking in with that, I think, is, as a self-practice, I think is so important. And I suppose one of the challenges, and that leads us to something I would love for you to explore with everyone, and talking about how you can begin to build that resilience and learn to adapt and in order to kind of better thrive through life's experiences. And in This Too Shall Pass, you've got your 8 pillars of strength. Can you tell us a little bit about each of those?
So the idea of the 8 pillars is that, you know, when the grind that we're standing on shifts, this feels like the foundations of our being are kind of shaken. And so the pillars that are kind of internal structures that kind of hold you steady when you feel very, very unsteady. And they're a set of beliefs and attitudes and ways of being that sort of support you and build steadiness. Because the big thing, when you're in a flux of change, your autonomic nervous system goes on alert. So you're kind of in fourth gear. And that means that your thinking isn't online. And so you can't really concentrate, you can't really think, and you just feel panic or frozen. And so while you're in a process of change, you want to bring your whole system to a kind of first or second gear where you can properly think, where you can listen to other people, you can inform yourself and give yourself a kind of steadiness in how you manage the waves that are coming of change that are coming at you. And so the pillars are, first of all, it's your relationship with yourself, which is your key relationship, and being self-compassionate to yourself. Then is your relationship to others, that when people look back on their lives, it's the love and connection to others that matters to them most, more than anything else. So that those two are really important. And then there's mind and body, which I'm sure you talk about a lot, is that everything we watch, listen to, see, eat affects our mood and how we are. But also that we need to kind of pay attention. So exercise, when we're kind of high on alert, is the fast track way to lower our system, because it tells your body that you've flown. It tells your body you're not in danger of the tiger attacking you now, that you're safe. So you feel calmer. So that, I mean, if I, with most clients, if I tell them only to do one thing, is I tell them to take exercise every day. And follow it with maybe even just the 5-minute meditation. And that's just like breathing in for 7 and out for 11 to kind of lower their system. And then I talk about other things like structure helps, limits, your relationship with time changes, and focusing. That you kind of give yourself some kind of practice where you're in relation with yourself and connected to yourself.
I love that there's so much emphasis on that nurturing and understanding that relationship to yourself. And I completely agree. I think that's why I enjoyed reading your book so much. It was so much of it. It was, you know, written in a way that I was like, that's what I articulating things. It's one of those books where, for me, when I was reading it, I was like, that's what I've been meaning or thinking for so long. It just articulated in a way that I wouldn't necessarily have the words for. And I just, yeah, and I completely agree. And I think it's about looking at that kind of 360. That's, to me, what a holistic approach is, when you're looking at what's happening physically, what can you do physically in order to allow space for the emotions and that connection to yourself and that focus. So I resonated with it so much. So moving on then, there's a few questions I always like to ask all of my guests in the podcast, and you've given so many sort of insights and bits of advice, but what would be your kind of, if you could encompass it into one, like, and this could be more general life advice, but what would be your biggest kind of bit of advice for listeners?
I guess you have to start with yourself, to know yourself and be self-compassionate rather than distract yourself and avoid yourself, because that is the center of it, really. That's where the root of how you live comes. And often people think of that as selfish. And I see it as the reverse, actually, is that once you've sorted yourself out, you're much more available for everybody else. Whereas if you don't really know yourself, you don't know what your needs are, you don't know how to get them met, you constantly kind of act out and make your life and everybody else's very difficult.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's really, really, really good bit of advice there. And where, obviously, this being the Curiosity Club, and curiosity and state of curiosity, as I like to call it, being one that I'm very passionate about, I love hearing what that means as a word to everyone. So how do you think it could be helpful? What does it mean to you?
I think it's starting at a place of not knowing. You know, that every time I meet a client, I don't know. So I start again. And it's a sort of energy to look and listen and learn and be open to new understandings or be open to watching a bird eat that you haven't kind of noticed before. Or, and you know, all the research shows that curiosity is one of the greatest supports in older age. People who are curious have, you know, better cognition, less physical pain. And so I think curiosity is that keeps our internal world expanded and alive and enriched. And that when we are not curious anymore, we kind of blinker ourselves to both the good and the bad in the world.
Yeah, I really like that. It's putting on the blinkers. And as you're saying that, it's about that openness and that beginner's mind, tapping into that. That's what I like to describe it as, that state of that beginner's mind state. And where, tell people where they can find you and find your work and both your wonderful books.
So I've got a website, www.juliasamuel.co.uk. I'm on Instagram at juliasamuelmbe, and I'm on Facebook. I think that's, I don't know, Julia Samuel MBE.
Okay, I'll find them and I'll pop them in the, I'll link them to, okay. I'll link all your website and your papers into the show notes so everyone can easily find you there. And I would encourage everyone to pick up at least Julia's newest book, which came out very recently. I didn't realize it was quite so recent, but thank you so, so much for joining us. It's been really, really insightful and wonderful talking to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope your listeners do too.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you leave a rating and review letting me know what your biggest takeaways were. I love reading each and every one. Thank you to Simproof for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget that you can get 15% off with discount code CuriosityClub15. As we're all curious folk around here, why not head over to simproof.com to find out more? Until next time, stay curious.